This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Should a former Playboy bunny really be on The View? Is that really the best we can do now?
Is The View serious journalism?
Well, they had serious journalists on it.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Jenny McCarthy of Education Policy, Michelle Gininger.
Thanks, Mike. That was insulting.
I thought I read it by you ahead of time.
No,
I know. That is not fair. But it gives us an excuse to talk about the decline of journalism. So she is a former Playboy bunny. Is what she's most famous for, among other things. And she's going to be on The View, which once upon a time had serious journalists.
It did. I mean, Barbara Walters, of course, a serious journalist. Meredith Vieira. I mean, it seems we're going downhill. I mean, we had Rosie O'Donnell for a while. Mm-hmm. I mean, these new women are not the ones we want to hold up for our girls. I mean, former Playboy model.
Yep. No, I hear you. All right. Well, sorry about that slander. All right. We'll try to move past that. Michelle's first time on the show. We're excited to have you with us. Michelle, I'm going to get your title wrong. What do we call you these days?
The Media Relations and Outreach Manager.
Thank you. I'm Media Relations and Outreach Manager. Yes. So Michelle is the one behind those press releases, some of the blog posts, and helping us get all kinds of great attention for our research studies and the like. And we're excited to have you on the show. Talk about some education policy happenings. It is summer, but there's still things going on out there.
Well, you make my job easy when we have such great research.
Ah, indeed. Well, that mostly goes to the Research Minute's Amber Winkler. She's the one behind that. Okay. Pamela is with us today to play Pardon the Gadfly. Pamela, let's get started.
In this week's Education Gadfly, Checker raises questions about the alternatives to the two main Common Core assessment consortia. What do you guys think?
Well, you know, Michelle, this is kind of fun because a few months ago, he raised some questions about the Common Core assessment consortia themselves, wondering whether they'd even survive all the way to 2015 when they're supposed to start giving tests. In this piece, what he says is, look, but some of these alternatives that people are talking about, whether by the ACT or other for-profit vendors, that these ones there's reason to be concerned as well that they're promising lower cost. They're promising that it's not going to take kids as much time for these tests, that they're going to be Common Core aligned. I am skeptical you can do all those things. And yet that's supposedly what the plan is in Oklahoma, where they're going to develop their own Common Core assessments.
I'm skeptical as well. But before we get to that, I would say Checker speaks his mind. I mean, he's going to say what he thinks about the testing consortia, and he's going to say what he thinks this week on the alternatives. I would say that it's concerning that 2 minutes after Common Core gets announced, there's all these Common Core aligned materials for sale. You have to wonder, are these really Common Core aligned? The idea behind Common Core is that we're doing something new. We're doing something a lot more rigorous, and that takes time. These tests are not supposed to be fill-in-the-bubble tests that we've been doing for years, and they're going to be more expensive. And so I'm skeptical that a lot of these tests are going to be cheap and as effective as we need them to be.
You know, this is playing out in Georgia right now, too. A lot of talk about how the tests are too expensive. They're going to go from something like $7 a test under their current system to something more like $18 a test under Common Core. You say, still, $18. Per pupil. We spend $10,000 per pupil in an education system. It is a rounding error, right? And for better or for worse, we know that these tests are the tail that's wagging the dog. I mean, they are having a huge impact. So really, we can't cough up an extra $11 per kid to make sure that those tests are actually high quality and are pushing teachers and our whole educational enterprise in the right direction. Come on, people.
Are you suggesting a new tax? I thought you were Republican.
I'm not saying tax. What tax? Come on. I can find that $11.
Yes, didn't you find
quite easily
six or $9 billion in one blog post a few weeks ago?
Yeah, I did. In fact, I did. One time I found out, I estimated that we are spending something like $3 billion a year just on obese teachers. Okay? If we tried to address the obesity epidemic among our teaching force, boom. We could easily come up with that $11 for kids. Okay. That's a little bit of a, you go look that one up, Michelle. That was before you were here. She would never let me publish that piece today, people.
It's true. I got to rein in the Fordham staff.
She would
sometime.
Not let me talk about fat teachers. Look there. I mean, look, my only point was that there is an obesity epidemic out there, and our teaching force is not immune. And in fact, if you spend time in schools, and there's some anecdotal evidence that it's probably worse in schools than some other places. It's a tough job. It leads to a very unhealthy lifestyle for some people. Okay.
Pamela, question number two, please.
Topic number two.
According to a technical report released by Fordham today, the Milwaukee Public School System has taken significant, if painful, steps towards resolving its perilous pension situation. What's the story?
Well, I think this is a story that's in every state of legislators kicking down the line pension costs. We promise pensions to these teachers and we just don't deliver. And Scott Walker took a step to make this better. It wasn't a popular step. It certainly doesn't win any votes. He's not going to get thanked by teachers, but he's making an effort to make his state more fiscally sound, and that deserves some credit.
So this report, it's a part of a project that we released the first study for a few weeks ago. This looks at Milwaukee. It's by Bob Castrell, Larry Maloney. They estimate what's going to happen over the course of 10 years if the pension situation and other retirement health care costs are not addressed. Now, what happened in Milwaukee while we were doing the study was suddenly Act 10 gets passed, thanks to Scott Walker. It says that things like benefits are suddenly off the table for bargaining. That gives school districts a lot more leeway. It also says, by the way, hey, no more with this policy where school districts can pick up the pension contributions of their teachers, which is what was happening in Milwaukee. So before the law, Milwaukee had bargained away this provision where it said, okay, we'll pay the employer contribution and the employee contribution. So employees are paying nothing into the pension system. They also had very lavish benefits for retirees. So you retire at age 55, you go on Medicare at 65. For those 10 years, you get, you know, very generous healthcare benefits, which is, it doesn't happen anywhere in the private economy. Well, as a result of Act 10, they were able to dramatically transform the retiree healthcare benefits to be, frankly, less generous, but also, in many ways, more fair to taxpayers. And they were able, the Milwaukee Public Schools were able to say, look, current teachers have got to pay their share for these pensions. As a result, Milwaukee is going to avoid what would have been a complete time bomb on its fiscal policies. By 2020, we estimated that they were going to be spending 20% of their money on retirement expenses. Okay, $1 out of every five just to pay for retired teachers before you even start talking about class size or teacher pay or technology or anything good. I mean, huge crushing costs that Act 10 is going to keep from happening.
But I don't think Milwaukee's out of the water here. I mean, they have a pay-as-you-go system, and so it's better. Scott Walker's actions are certainly made it a lot better, but they're not clear out of the water, and they still have some work to do.
Right, and then the pay-as-you-go is for this retirement health care. This is something people don't talk about. There's been more talk about pensions lately, and people kind of get it, that these pension systems have been underfunded or in many cases raided by politicians at some point. The retiree health care thing is saying, look, we're going to promise these generous benefits for teachers after they retire, before they get Medicare, but we're not going to put any money away for it. And so guess what? Baby boomers are retiring and suddenly they want these benefits and we haven't saved a penny for it. It is going to crush us unless the school districts are able to say, look, I'm sorry, but you're 55. I cannot pay free health care for you for the next 10 years. That's just not defensible.
So the Badger State has some more work to do. The question is, will other states follow suit?
Nice,
at
Michelle.
All.
Excellent. And you even threw in the state nickname. We love state nicknames here at Fordham.
I know only about 10 state nicknames, so if you throw out one I don't know,
all right, well,
I might be in trouble.
Excellent. Okay, topic number three.
For the second time in 2 years, the Florida Board of Education voted to change the school grading system so that the grades will not decline by more than one letter regardless of student test performance after test results indicated that school grades would fall. Is this the right move?
Look, I can understand the challenge here. To have an accountability system that passes the laugh test and that has face validity, that has credibility out there with the public, you can't have school grades, you know, swinging wildly from one year to the next. You're going to say, wait a minute, last year this was a great school and now this school sucks? I mean, that's just a little bit hard to believe. On the other hand, you do want to continuously raise standards and you want to get better measurements. We've got Common Core coming, which is going to show that, you know, our schools are not doing as well as they should be. So, you know, there's got to be some balance. You know, I I think this particular policy is okay, but let's not go overboard here, people.
I'm torn on this. I mean, on one hand, the whole reason of higher standards of Common Core is to hold our schools, our teachers, our students accountable to the level that they're performing. Too many tests don't say what the reality is. And I think we need to really make sure we're telling the truth. What's the point of accountability if it's not actual? On the other hand, I don't want to penalize schools or penalize teachers or penalize students while we're making a transition. Mm-hmm.
You know, in Florida, the background here, as I understand it, is that in the first few years of the A to F system, there were quite a few D's and F's. And then over time, those schools moved up the grades. And so for a while, they got to the point where there were almost no D's and F's in the whole state. And you say, all right, granted, Florida's performance was improving. And so the schools were doing better. But, you know, again, were we letting some bad schools off the hook? Were we making the grades too easy? And so, you know, getting this balance right is difficult. I appreciate what the state leaders are trying to do here is that we want to keep ratcheting up expectations, keep pressure on the system to keep the achievement gains going. But we want to do it in a way that's fair and that's defensible.
And Florida, the Sunshine State, also has...
Nice.
Tony Bennett, which I think, so the nation is watching Florida, not only for Tony Bennett coming out of Indiana, but also because the Florida story has always been the ed reform state to hold up. So we need to make sure that Florida especially is doing this right.
You know, Tony Bennett, who had a great tan even before he got that Florida job. I can only imagine what his tan must be like now.
Hopefully not orange.
Hopefully not orange. You're referring to what, John Boehner's tan?
You know, maybe Ohio, Indiana area gets more sun than Florida.
Yeah, you wonder. I think that Boehner ends up playing a lot of that golf he plays in Florida. All right, that is all the time we've got for this week. Great job, Michelle. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And now it's time for everyone's favorite Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
So I have an important pressing question to start with before we go on to the Research Minute.
Ready.
Should a former Playboy bunny really be on The View? Is that really the best we can do now?
Is The View serious journalism?
Well, they had serious journalists on it at one point.
I don't know. Ever since Barbara Walters joined it, I think she lost some credibility when she joined The View.
She was kind of a serious journalist, right?
She was on
news programs.
I can see your research chart of just the downward slope of journalism standards.
Anyway.
I don't know. It's just interesting because I assume that The View's target demographic is it's not like 22-year-old men, right? So
right.
I'm not sure what exactly you gain with the Playboy bunny.
That's true. Yeah. You got mostly single moms with kids home watching it.
Although, you know, she is a mom.
Yes,
she is a mom.
She is.
So there you go. We have figured it out. All right, Amber. I don't know. You didn't really give a strong answer. That was very good. See, Michelle has given you some media training. You very nicely bobbed and weaved from that question answering it directly.
Yes. I mean, I think it's all about the ratings, right? And she's got, I heard a quote that she's controversial yet can be serious. And whatever, maybe must be a good fit.
Excellent. Yes. They'll be discussing autism, I think, which is her big issue. Okay.
That's right.
All right, Amber. What do you have for us this week?
We got a new report. America's Children, Key National Indicators of Well-Being. It sounds boring, but it has a ton of really interesting data in here. Okay. It pulls from about 20 different data sources, variety of agencies, big installment. But anyway, I pulled out some highlights. It's about a bunch of indicators around family environment and health and education. Some of the stuff that you really get jazzed about.
I was going to say, this does not sound boring to me. I love this stuff.
You love this stuff.
I should have been a sociologist.
Key findings. First, the numbers. In 2012, there were 73.7 million children ages 0 to 17. That's about 24% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
Relative to the family environment, in 2011, the adolescent birth rate was 15 per 1,000 adolescents. Rate has fallen, as you know, four consecutive years this rate's been falling. 64% of children age 0 to 17 live with two married parents in 2012.
That again. How many?
64%.
Mm-hmm.
Down from 77% in 1980. This is a new indicator that they now can measure. How many children live with two unmarried parents in 2012? Have any idea?
I bet
two
about
unmarried parents.
About 10%.
Four.
Okay.
Economically, in 2011.
But what we're saying then, you add those numbers together, you say something like about a third of kids are living with only one adult. parent.
Right.
And not even a parent, right? Yeah. So we're saying, you know, a third of the kids are growing up in fatherless families. Let's say it that way.
Economically, in 2011, 22% of all children lived in poverty, not significantly different from 2010. So relative to physical environment, I'm just going through all these different categories. The percentage of children aged 4 to 11 with a detectable level of recent exposure to secondhand smoke declined from 53% in 2007 to 42% in 2009-10. Does that still seem high? Because it still seems high to me.
It does seem high.
I mean, really, that's a lot of kids exposed to secondhand smoke. Hmm. Moving on. Relative to behaviors, binge drinking among 12th graders rose from 22% in 2011 to 24% in 2012. Mm. That's not good. Mm-hmm. Relative to education, in 2011, 91%, this is a pretty generous way they operationalized this, 91% of young adults ages 18 to 24 completed high school, either with a diploma or a GED. Relative to health, in 2009-10, 18% of children were obese, which was not different from 07-08. So it's still high, but it's not changing. And then they got this neat little section on kindergarten. Don't be interrupted, Michelle. Just kidding. She's new. I got to teach her the ropes.
I know. Bad at the time.
I know. And it's 2 minutes. It's a long report. This is my last point.
I was going to tease Mike.
Special section on kindergarten. Red shirting is beneficial, is what they say. The older a kid starts kindergarten, the better his performance across all subject areas.
Yeah.
So anyway, there you have it.
We've all read our Malcolm Gladwell. We know how to work that one. Yeah, absolutely. Hold the kid back. I mean, why not?
That's help right. Why not?
Yeah. Absolutely. Interesting. So, you know, look, this is still, we have, so a quarter of the population are kids and a quarter of the kids are poor. And that is a lot. And the big question is whether as the recession and the unemployment crisis gets behind us, if those numbers are going to start to drop. Mm-hmm. We sure hope so, because those numbers are as high as they have been in decades.
Right. But you know, because you've been studying this stuff, that it's temporary. It's fluid. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So it's very circumstantial. You know, your mom gets a job or your dad gets, you know what I mean? It's just very circumstantial.
Well, that's good and bad. I mean, that means that poverty is affecting many more than just a quarter of the kids.
Yeah,
that
that's there's half more full than, or half empty.
Right.
That's
there's many more kids experiencing poverty. But in any given day, there's a quarter that are in poverty right now.
You're always saying that kids don't stay in poverty their entire childhood.
Most do not, right. But that's right. And this issue of, look, with 30% plus kids in fatherless families, this is the killer. It is a killer, in my opinion.
It matters.
All right. Thank you, Amber.
Sure.
Lots of good stuff. See, it's the summer and we can still do an education policy podcast, people. Yes.
When you're back from the undisclosed locations, i.e. beaches.
Yes, that's true.
People, stop smoking. That's the other thing I want to say.
All right. And I do hope somebody's going to watch The View for us. Let us know if we're being unfair to Jenny McCarthy. Okay, that is all the time we've got for this week. Until next week.
I'm Michelle Gininger.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.